questions people have? Last minute questions?
Before, after?
Okay. I'm going to make sure I cover everything.
It's okay. Bring the extreme.
Yeah, there you go.
So we're going to take the quiz at the end because Kent, I want to make sure I cover everything that's on the quiz. What does that tell you? Kidneys. Yes. It's really easy. Super hard. No, I'm joking. Okay. It's very easy. Generally, don't stress. Try to get your confidence built up because next week all the confidence goes down. No. Okay. So, I am sadistic. No, that's good. Because that way we get everybody in class. It's kind of filling up today. Wouldn't you have a quiz in every class? That's bad, isn't it? Okay. So the quiz is at the end for a reason. Get you all in here. Relatively easy quiz. And what are we doing on Thursday?
Another quiz.
And we're getting you ready for what next week?
Exam.
And when are we taking those exams next week? In your lab, right. So, and there's four different exams being made. I'm up all night trying to think of wild questions for you. Okay. So, some of you had lab this week, right? Monday class. How did it go? Was it awful? Did you get the compound potential to start with in saline?
Yeah.
Everybody get that? Okay. No? No? Was your prep dead or something?
Yeah. That and our devices were working.
Okay. Our entire lab section was like...
Was it the first lab? Are you Monday morning?
No, it was the second
lab. Second lab? That's kind of
Monday morning.
Monday morning was okay?
All of our computers were just like...
Oh, they're rebooting. Some of them were rebooting. It's crazy.
Yeah, ours decided that the script wasn't working after we did the first...
And then it just quit.
Switch to a different computer.
Okay. Sometimes you can combine together whatever the TAs try to do.
I mean, we didn't even get to the point of putting your data in the computer.
Oh, good. But hopefully you saw a compound action potential. So what is a compound action potential versus a single action potential? It's multiple neurons firing, right? And then they add together, and then you get a general compound action potential. And you might have seen... I think on the lab that you're working with, the time frame they have, you're basically seeing one compound action potential. But if you stretched it out longer, you might see a little bleep and another bleep, and those are different groups of neurons firing at a different velocity, right? Conduction velocity. But anyways, at least you get to see, most of you, the frog action potential, compound action potential from multiple neurons, single neurons inside of the nerve that were firing, and you got a general response. When you put Ugonol on, what happened? We'll give it away for the Wednesday group, right? Did you put Ugonol on? Did you have a chance to put Ugonol on? Did it have an effect?
Yeah, it slowed it down.
It slowed it down, some of you? It wasn't significant? It didn't do anything?
For our lab, it was.
For your lab, it was. For another lab, it was. What happened to it? Did it get bigger? Did it get smaller?
Increased.
Yeah. Are you serious? Were you watching the artifact, or were you watching the compound potential? I want to make sure, because one time I've seen people measuring the artifacts in there. So how about other people? Did it? What happened? When you added it, you let it sit in the Ugonol, and then you put it back on the wires, anything happened?
It required
a higher stimulus voltage. So you kind of get an idea of ready for Wednesday, right? You know, what's going on? And has anybody looked up what is Ugonol? Yes?
It's anesthetic.
It's kind of anesthetic. Has anybody ever used clove oil themselves? It's commonly used. You can get it at health food store. Put on your, like a child's teething, for example. Your parents might have used it on you. You can pick it up. It's just clove leaves that are smashed up, and they rub it on your gum when you're teething, for example. After you do a little research on it, you probably don't want to be using it that much, right? And so in clove oil itself, when you grind it up, you have multiple compounds. The active ingredient that is the anesthetic is eugenol. But in the clove, when you rub up the leaves, you actually get another compound too called isoeugenol, and it's actually carcinogenic, but it's at low levels in there. But probably not a great idea to be ingesting too much of that stuff. When we worked on it this summer with some undergraduates and a student that was from Germany visiting, we were actually putting crustaceans into this stuff as an anesthetic to look at what happens to the whole animal with crabs, shrimp, and crayfish. And I was getting it on my hands, and after a little while, I could taste it in my tongue. So what does that tell you? It got right into your bloodstream and, you know, into your body. That's why I'm still crazy. No, and so it does something that you want to watch out for. So make sure you wear gloves in the lab. Okay, so hopefully you're working with that. It's a pretty neat compound. It's actually used quite a bit in the fish industry. People anesthetize fish with it if they want to put markers on them, for example, because some fish are very hard to work with and might even be dangerous to the handler. So they actually put it in the water, anesthetize the fish, they can put markers on them, and then just wash the water out, and they come right back to life. It's pretty amazing. If you put a whole crayfish or a crab into this eugenol, you pick them up, and their legs just kind of flop down. They just become limp. And we thought we killed them this summer, and then we put them back into fresh water, and they all came back feisty as ever, ready to pinch you. It was just like, whoa, what happened? So it's really quite neat that they can come back that quickly. I don't think you've washed out didn't have time to wash out the nerves that you were working with on the sciatics, right? But you can imagine you could probably try to wash it out and see if it would come back and how long it would take to come back also. So that's another neat aspect of that lab. So this is a new lab that hasn't been used before in 350, so we're trying to change it up every year a little bit, which is an indication. Remember on your lab reports, you didn't have a GCSCR this week, right? Right? But if you do have to write up lab reports later, do watch out, because people tend to take their students or friends or something they find online from last year, and procedures change, right? So you don't want to be copying and pasting. Remember, that's a big no-no. And all the Turnitin assignments pop that up. So be careful with all that kind of work. All right, so we're going to take the quiz at the end of class, because I know some people will probably work their way in. And next week we have an exam, your first exam. Blow away your first exam because it's probably the easiest exam through the semester, right? And a lot of open response questions, a lot of short answers, some fill in the blanks. But that makes it easier for you to expand on what you know instead of just maybe guessing, you know, C all the way down, right? Sometimes that gets you a passing grade in some classes. But open response, short answers. And you'll have enough time, so to reduce the stress, because you got the whole lab time, but it won't take you that long. It's really meant to be about an hour in, you know, or so long, right? So you've got the whole time period. So that will help reduce stress, and hopefully, and you're broken up into groups, so you're not crammed in on top of each other, so hopefully that'll help you think about what you're learning. Remember, we want concepts, right, and understanding of the concepts in here, just not trying to memorize. So do look through the test bank. That would help you. Are you looking at that? Everybody knows the test bank is on under files, right, under the Canvas. So the test bank, lots of test questions in there, and some of them don't have answers. That's for you to look up. And then at the top of your webpage, you also have two summers of tests that you can look through as well. So a lot of stuff that you can study. And I think it's a good idea to look through old exams. You can even go online, do a Google search, write physiology test questions, test bank, and you'll pop up questions. It's a nice review. I mean, you'll get a test out of Australia or something, and it's the same kind of questions, you know, generally. How the neuron works, how synaptic transmission works, what's lambda, what's tau, it's all the same. Okay, so you can use that as study guides. I know you all have all that free time to do that, right? No other class but this class. I'm joking. I know you have lots of other things to do. But in your spare time, do kind of study a bit. Okay, so other aspects that we want to understand, we're trying to make sure you understand the general nature of science, right? Experimentation, look up, you know, information, theories change, ideas change, right? You might have an idea of how this works. And then new experiments come up, or new findings come up, and it changes the way. That's the beauty of science, right? Is that based on evidence that you come up with. So let's go through some of this. We stopped Any questions in general right now that you're having problems with on any concepts? Remember your Facebook group, you could email each other or Facebook each other, whatever you want to do, ask them. Stimulate your brain cells, right? Good. So we left off talking about synaptic transmission last time and understanding a bit about how vesicles fuse, and lots of textbooks have different diagrams for this. But generally, an action potential comes down the nerve. This is not diagrammed, right? This is just the schematic. But generally, right, an action potential comes down the nerve. What's unique at the nerve terminal are these voltage-gated calcium channels, right? And not like this shown in this diagram, but usually the voltage-gated calcium channels are right next to where the vesicles dock. Remember we talked about docking vesicles? The proteins that allow the vesicle to dock right there, there's some proteins in the plasma membrane that actually connect in and hold together the voltage-gated calcium channels. So that's pretty cool, because right there is where the calcium is going to come in, and that's where those other proteins are that monitor calcium, right, release the brake, and allow the vesicle to fuse. So you'll get a burst of calcium right here next to where those vesicles are docked, and then vesicles will fuse related to that calcium. So how do you, you know, look at this, and how did people study this in the 1950s? Well, Bernard Katz, clap your hands. He's just one of those gods, right? He actually studied this as well. So it's really quite interesting of how he described this. So let's go through a little diagram here, and this might help. And I think, like we did before, drawing on here just kind of puts it in context. So hopefully this will work. All right. So I'll draw my stereotypic nerve terminal. Nobody wants $100 yet. Nobody's found a neuromuscular junction in mammalian preparation where they've recorded inside the nerve terminal with an intracellular electrode to look at the shape of the action potential. Nobody wants $100. Nobody wants $100. Okay. We're still waiting for you. Okay, so the action potential comes down the nerve terminal, opens up voltage-gated calcium channels, right? Calcium comes in. Causes black magic. No, joking. The vesicle fuses to the membrane, right? Releases transmitter, binds to the postsynaptic cleft, right? Just like that diagram over there. There's lots of vesicles inside the nerve terminal. Depends on the type of nerve terminal, but you'll have some that are docked, ready to go, and others that are kind of up in a reserve pool. So this is really interesting. As I mentioned before, a number of Nobel Prizes have been awarded basically to understand the mechanisms of synaptic transmission, because it's so fundamental, from a fruit fly to you to a worm, right? And even in yeast, how the membrane buds to the membrane on the yeast. Same kind of basic properties in some aspects. These proteins are highly conserved. And remember we talked about botulinum before? Right? Remember, botulinum is what cleaves some of these proteins that hold the vesicle there. So botulinum, if you cleave these proteins, like that one right there, you cleave it, then the vesicle can't fuse to the membrane. And that's why you die from botulinum poisoning. Right? Okay. So, and there's lots of different forms of botulinum. Some people take it for medicinal purposes, like to stop blepharospasms, so your eye from twitching too much, or maybe laryngeal spasms, or cosmetic use, but you've got to be careful with that stuff. It kills people, too. Okay, so let's look at how can we understand synaptic transmission? Well, Bernard Katz did some really neat work. He recorded with an extracellular electrode close to the nerve terminal, and he recorded away from the nerve terminal. And so we found some really neat aspects. So let's look at this. If you record right underneath the nerve terminal, what he found, so let's call that number one, let's call this number two out here. If he recorded right underneath number one, he could record over time these little bleeps. If he records out here, like where number two is, if he could record simultaneously, they might be really small and maybe just disappearing in the baseline noise. So what he found is the closer you are to the nerve terminal, the bigger these responses are, and the better you could see them. So he found a gradation away from the nerve terminal. So this is that, basically, what we've already talked about, lambda, right? As you go along, the cell from the point of injection of the current, it decrements due to all those properties that we talked about. Membrane resistance, capacitance. It's a graded response, right? This is without stimulation. So if he stimulated now the nerve terminal and recorded there, so let's do one, but let's put an S next to it with stimulation. What he found is you can get to some size, and then all of a sudden, boom, you got this big signal. And with an extracellular recording, it was just an extracellular spike. If you stabbed inside the muscle fiber, which didn't come until later, if you stabbed inside the muscle fiber, then you could see this graded response and then the action potential of the skeletal muscle, like in a frog skeletal muscle or in a mammalian skeletal muscle. And two, if you recorded in two with an extracellular electrode, it was just a kind of a spike like that. But if you could do it with an intracellular electrode, so number two with a stimulus with intracellular, then you can actually see a nice action potential like you saw up here in one if you were intracellular electrode. But something was different. You didn't see that little bump anymore like you did up here, right? Because why? That's a threshold for an action potential on the muscle fiber, just like in the nerve. Out here, you're just recording the action potential that traveled down the muscle fiber, okay? So he began to wonder, if you go up to some high stimulation and that membrane in the muscle fiber depolarizes enough, boom, you got this action potential. But if you're below that threshold, it's a small response. And it's graded. You get some that are bigger and some that are smaller. So he did some really neat experiments. And that's what we'll show here. Okay, so what he did is he looked again at the nerve terminal. Okay? And recorded later with intracellular electrodes, recorded inside the muscle fiber. So initially, if you wanted to block synaptic transmission here, you didn't want a whole bunch of vesicles to fuse, what might you be able to do now knowing some of the properties that we talked about? What might you do if you didn't want a lot of vesicles to fuse so you wouldn't go above that graded response and fire an action potential, that threshold? What could you do here? What do you know that's going to cause a lot of vesicles to fuse?
Calcium,
right? So what might you do as an experimental design? Think of you're back in the 1950s, knowing that calcium plays a role in synaptic transmission. Go for it.
How about calcium channels there?
Yeah, you could lower the calcium, right?
So you know what the channels?
You just know that they're calcium channels. You don't know the type.
Okay, well, block the calcium.
Yeah, lower. Did you say something else?
I said
to block the calcium. Yeah, block the calcium. So what kind of blockers block voltage-gated calcium channels? I know we haven't covered all that, but there might have been some other course. Cadmium can block the voltage-gated calcium channels. Magnesium blocks the voltage-gated calcium channels. Or you could lower the calcium. So magnesium, Mg2+, or cadmium, Cd2+. This is why you don't throw those cadmium batteries if you're out on a boat. You don't throw them over into the lake. You know, when your flashlight goes out, the cadmium is very toxic. It's toxic to you, too. This is a big problem if somebody swallows those batteries. Hopefully it stays sealed and just passes right through. But if you have swallowed a cadmium battery, it might, if it comes apart and you get cadmium in you, your history, right? Because that cadmium is very toxic. It blocks the voltage-gated calcium channels. So Bernard Katz did these kind of experiments. He actually did some really neat experiments. He did one with lowered calcium. Okay, that would decrease. So now if he recorded inside there, if he didn't have that, he gets up to threshold and boom, you got the action potential, right? But if he put cadmium, low calcium, in the bath, he could get this below the level and it wouldn't fire, right? So when he's stimulating the nerve terminal. Or he could raise the cadmium or magnesium, right? And it would block these voltage-gated calcium channels, so he would have fewer vesicles to fuse. And again, just a graded response below the level of the threshold. Okay, so that's some neat experiments that he could do. And so this is with stimulation. And then if he just recorded without stimulation, so now without stimulating the nerve, and he used low calcium or high cadmium or magnesium, he still would get spontaneous events that would occur. Now, that's kind of odd, isn't it? Spontaneous events that would occur. So what does that tell you?
He could block these voltage-gated calcium channels or reduce the calcium in the bath, maybe even to zero, or put a high amount of cadmium in there. What does that tell you? That it would block the voltage-gated calcium channels, but if he recorded in the muscle fiber, you could still get these little bleeds. Experimental nature of science is thinking about things, right? Experimentation. What might you postulate then? If you were still getting bleeps in this postsynaptic site, but you're blocking the evoked.
Calcium leak channel?
Maybe there's a calcium leak channel. That could be. Maybe calcium is just leaking and it's a different type of calcium channel. What else might you think about? Do the vesicles have to have calcium to fuse? Maybe not, right? Maybe they're just random. Maybe some vesicles will just fuse randomly in the background, like a background tone going on, right? Because actually in development, when the nerve finds a target cell, like your muscle, multiple nerves will grow to your muscle fiber, and they communicate. The ones that are the strongest will stay there, and the others prune back. And it's still a question, what are these spontaneous, so the key word is spontaneous, quantal events, and I'll tell you why they're called quantal. So they're called spontaneous events that occur. You do not need the nerve to be stimulated, and you can block voltage-gated calcium channels. Maybe it's from calcium leak. Maybe there's calcium inside of the nerve terminal that can kind of add to this property. And remember what happened when we stimulated the nerve terminal? Where did that calcium go that came in through the voltage-gated calcium channels? Remember, where did it go? Some got pumped out, right? Some got exchanged out through the sodium calcium exchanger. Some went into mitochondria. Some bound to calcium binding proteins. And those came off in time, right? And so maybe it's that residual calcium. Inside of the nerve terminal is also the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER, right, of the cell. And it can take up calcium. It actually has pumps that can pump calcium into the ER. And then it doesn't want to just keep taking calcium up, but it will come out in time as well. So maybe it's that calcium that's just in the nerve terminal coming off of previous activity, right? And that calcium can cause those vesicles to fuse. So people are still questioning to this day, even after it's been discovered in the 1950s, what is the purpose of spontaneous vesicle fusion? Is it to contact that target and say, I'm still here, this is the nerve terminal, don't prune back? It's still a question about what are these spontaneous events doing for the postsynaptic terminal. And maybe it's maintaining that terminal. Okay, so that's kind of neat. So something else that Bernard Katz did, because he was just one of those wonderful people, is that he found out that at the frog neuromuscular junction, these are like your neuromuscular junctions, they're nicotinic acetylcholine receptors that are there. So why do we call these? Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that's released from the nerve terminal, and the type of receptors that are on your skeletal muscle are called nicotinic receptors. They are acetylcholine receptors, but pharmacologically you can divide up the type of acetylcholine receptors. For some reason people get confused with this sometimes, and I know if it's the first time you heard it, it might be confusing. So the receptors, you have acetylcholine receptors, just like glutamate receptors, you have different subtypes of these receptors. One subtype at your neuromuscular junctions are called nicotinic because nicotine will activate them. Okay? Other types of acetylcholine receptors in your brain are called muscarinic receptors because muscarin will work on those. Okay, so they're divided up into classes. Well, he found out that there was this drug that you could use and you could actually block the receptors. And so he found out that people in South America were finding out these frogs that the native people could rub their arrows on and shoot a monkey out of the tree with it, and it would paralyze them. So he began to wonder, what is this? So they found curare. And curare will block the acetylcholine receptors. So these acetylcholine receptors can be blocked. Okay? So if he puts in a little bit of curare in this preparation, but if he puts in too much, what's going to happen? If he puts in too much with stimulation, you don't get anything, right?
So increased curare. I'll just write C-U-R. All right. But if you don't have too much, just a little bit of curare, then you could see some small miniature potentials. And if he's stimulated now with stimulation, so this was without stimulation, with stimulation, and you tried to stimulate, you could maybe stay below the threshold and you wouldn't fire an action potential. All right, so the idea is that you could block those postsynaptic receptors. You could have high calcium in the back, but if you took away many of these, like let's take away all of the except one, you release the same amount of transmitter, maybe multiple vesicles, but you can't get enough depolarization of the target cell to get above threshold to fire an action potential. So Bernard Katz did all these kind of experiments in the 1950s, really cool stuff. You can think he's paying attention to the literature that's being published out, you know, taking away these frogs that would, you know, be scrape their skin and shoot a monkey out of the tree or something. And then he figured out about calcium and cadmium and magnesium. Really neat stuff. But he wanted to understand what are these little miniature things that are happening, these spontaneous events, and then what makes it reach an action, a threshold to fire an action potential. So he came up with what's called the quantal hypothesis. Let me find another piece of paper. Okay. So he did some really neat experiments. He recorded underneath the nerve terminal just by recording. Okay. So what he found is all those kind of things, right, that we talked about. Spontaneous quantal events. And we'll mention why these are again. So he measured the amplitude of these things. Okay, and he got a variety of amplitudes. So he plotted this. He recorded the frequency of events, okay, the frequency of events and the size of them. And these are the spontaneous events, right? So he found some that were small, some that were bigger, some that were bigger, and he got a population. Let's say that's about 0.5 millivolts in amplitude. So he had a nice curve here, you know, a nice bell-shaped curve. Okay, sometimes you got a few bigger events, so it's a little skewed, but generally, around a half a millivolt on average. Remember, there's variation in there. Then he did the experiment again, but this time stimulated the nerve terminal. So now he's stimulating the nerve terminal. Okay, and he records. So he gets this time a bigger event. The next time he stimulates, he gets kind of a bigger event, but it's still below threshold. If he went above threshold, what are you going to get? An action potential. So he stayed below threshold. He either played with the curare, played with the magnesium, played with the cadmium, or played with lower calcium. Any of these kind of experiments. So he did it in multiple ways, because that's what you do in science. You try it multiple ways to try to prove your point. And then he found some smaller events if he added more curare, right? And if he added higher cadmium, it would flatline. And if he added, you know, some maybe some more calcium, tried to displace the cadmium, maybe he'd get another event. And so these are all evoked events, you see. So stimulating and recording these events. So he measured the amplitude of all of these. That one's a zero, right? Measured the amplitude of all these events that are sub-threshold. And then he plotted that. The frequencies of these and the size. But these are evoked events now. Right? And so he plotted, he got some small ones, he got some big ones, really big ones, small ones, and then sometimes he got some other ones that were like this, and maybe he had some that were like that. And so he found, well, if I gave a lot of curare, my diagrams were kind of like this. He could have changed this. If he gave less curare, he might have had bigger events, right? And so what he actually found when he did these experiments, this distribution would change. But basically, he'd see something like this, three different or four different or maybe more different size groupings. That's pretty cool. But he noticed, why are they in groupings? And then he looked at the peak average of these, and he found out they're about 0.5 differences apart. Wow. Well, if he looked at the minis, they were of this average size, right? So he came up with what was termed transmission must be released in packets. these packets are of a quantum in nature, a quantum, because he knew it light energy, you know, the packets of a photon is a quantum, right? So he borrowed the physics terms and used it as a quantum of transmitter. So he called this a quantal response, because transmission was released in quantal packets, like a packet of transmitter. And then they did not know that there were vesicles inside the nerve terminal. They did not have the imaging to go with that. It wasn't until later that electron microscopy was described. So he already postulated, based on the physiology, that transmitter is released in packets. When electron microscopy came around, guess what? Some of the first preparations that were looked at with electron microscopy, the frog neuromuscular junction, because they had so much physiology on it. So they were looking at, and they found these things, these vesicles. So what would you do? Put two and two together, right? Transmitter is probably packaged in these vesicles, and it fuses and releases. And since the 1950s to this day, people still study this property and understanding vesicle fusion, because it's the fundamentals of how your brain works, how your nerves work on your muscles, how all animals work in their nervous system. So it's still being studied. And all those mutations that we talked about, like protein mutations, right? You have one mutation in a particular calcium channel, or maybe one of those many vesicle proteins that hold the vesicle there, or maybe sense calcium, is going to affect synaptic transmission, right? So it could explain learning deficits. It could explain so many problems if your nervous system not developing. They're looking at it with autistic brains. They're looking at it in all different ways. Schizophrenia, other problems. Are there mess-ups in those properties that could change how the nervous system develops, right? Because it's so fundamental. So the take-home here is quantal hypothesis is Bernard Capps' thing. He described that. But also he described that multiple vesicles would fuse to get above threshold and fire an action potential, right, in the skeletal muscle. He also did early experiments in your favorite preparation, the crayfish, earlier on, because in the crayfish, like your preparations, many of the crayfish muscles do not produce action potentials. They're graded. So he could actually have more calcium and see a bigger response. And at the crayfish neuromuscular junction, they're not acetylcholine ergic. They don't release acetylcholine at the crayfish neuromuscular junctions. Many of the invertebrates, there are some exceptions, but many of the invertebrates use glutamate as the transmitter at the neuromuscular junction. Your crayfish that you're looking at used glutamate as the neurotransmitter. So Karari doesn't have any effect. But what he could do is use different blockers for the glutamate receptors. We'll get into that later, but actually to understand your brain and how your glutamate receptors work, many of the early experiments in the pharmacology were actually done on the crayfish neuromuscular junction and in the locus neuromuscular junction to classify the pharmacological agents that work on your brain for the glutaminergic synapses. That's pretty cool. So you can understand these preparations, but in the crayfish, then you don't have to worry about a threshold because you don't get an action potential. So the more you released, then you got a bigger response. So that's pretty neat to think about. Questions on quantal hypothesis? Anything? You understand? What is a quantum then? A quantum is?
A package.
And what's that package relate to? What do you call those round things?
Vesicles,
right? So a vesicle inside of the nerve terminal, right? And you could have multiple vesicles. When you have a lot of calcium come in, what's going to happen? Multiple vesicles are going to fuse at the same time, and you can get that evoked response. What if you cooled the preparation down? What do you think would happen? Let's cool it down. What causes the... This is just thinking out of the box. You know, it's not something you're going to get in the textbook right away, right? What causes these vesicles to bind to the nerve terminal, just to hold them there? The proteins, right? What causes the vesicle to then fuse into the membrane? Calcium binding to a protein that causes a conformational change. That's a protein changing its chain, its structure. Do you think that higher temperatures or lower temperatures are going to make a change in that conformational change, right? Maybe even opening up voltage-gated calcium channels will be temperature-dependent, right? Because it's a protein changing its conformation, right? So you could cool the frog prep down. You could cool the crayfish preparation down. You could cool your muscles down. And what's going to happen when you stimulate the nerve terminal? All these kind of slow down in their movements, right? So the calcium channel might not all open at the same time. The proteins might not all sense the calcium at the same time. They're going to have to kind of change their structure. The fusion process. This is actually very complicated when you think about it. There are people that have spent their whole careers, 50 years, just looking at how that bilipid membrane fuses to this bilipid membrane. Because what do you have to do? You have to break the bilipid membrane, and that takes energy, right? It takes energy to fuse that membrane into this membrane and release that content, and then pinch it back off so it can recycle and refuse. So people study that. They study the biophysics of how much energy it takes to actually break open the bilipid membrane. Isn't that wild? So you can imagine when it's cold, that might be congealed, right? So now you understand, you know, that there's a lot to that, right? So lower temperature, and that's what Bernard Katz did again. He actually reduced the temperature, and he saw a more broad response in the multiple quantal events that occurred. So it kind of had latency jitter, too. And so you could think about, instead of recording like that, he would get something maybe like this. And that's one quantum, another one building on top, and another one building on top. What does that remind you of, too? Back to those parameters that we talked about. Tau, right? And all that good stuff. So you have to integrate all these things, right? So if they came down really fast, they wouldn't build on each other. So it's basically like the dendrites of your neurons in your brain, right? Or in your spinal cord. So now they could use the neuromuscular junction to kind of understand these facilitated responses. So Bernard Katz did those really neat experiments too. He kept it below the threshold, and he stimulated repetitively. Okay? That's pretty cool.
So it wasn't that he couldn't get it to go above the threshold. He just didn't want it to.
He didn't want it to, because as soon as you got an action potential, it's not graded anymore. And now it's the properties like voltage-gated sodium channels on the plasma membrane of the muscle fiber. And so you can't understand the properties of the presynaptic component if you had an action potential. See, now it becomes more of the driving of the muscle fiber and the sodium going in.
So the graded response is just where you can see the bump.
Yes. You can see the individual quantal responses. And if you had too many quantal responses, like maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 building up, and then all of a sudden that would build up to be above threshold, what do you get? Boom, an action potential. And so you couldn't see the properties of the presynaptic vesicle fusion events because now you're looking at the postsynaptic action potential that's produced. You get it? Is that all that muddy, clear in your brains, right? Caffeine helps in the morning. Just to let you know, caffeine helps. Okay, so he did these kind of experiments where he repetitively stimulated the nerve terminal. Okay, so he repetitively stimulated sub-threshold. What did he get? He got inside this muscle fiber. What is he going to get? 1 response, 2 response, 3 response, 4 response, maybe something like that. It's still sub-threshold, okay? So it's sub-threshold. Threshold's up here. This is where people get confused. It's sub-threshold. Why is this event bigger than this event? I mean, why is this event here bigger than that event? It's still sub-threshold. Summation, and it's summating, but it hasn't come quite back down. It's not just, I'm not just measuring from the baseline here, right? So this is tau. It could be building up on this, but actually, it's more than just building up on the decay of the upstroke, right? It's not just the summation on there. It's actually a bigger event. What caused these events to first place? What caused the first event? What causes first event?
Vesicles
fusing, binding to receptors. And you got a depolarization. The size of that depolarization is dependent on what? As soon as you think of synapses, there's two things that you have to think in your brain. You can divide up the columns. This is a hint for next week. Divide up the columns. Presynaptic, postsynaptic. What would be the reasons presynaptically for a bigger event? Graded, subthreshold. What causes the event? Vesicles to fuse, which is related to the calcium. So if you have more vesicles fusing, would you get a bigger response? Yes.
with the assumption that you haven't saturated the receptors, right? Okay, haven't saturated the receptors. So, since you're getting a bigger event with multiple stimulations, you know you didn't saturate the postsynaptic event. So what do you actually then think about? You're going to get $1 million from NIH, you solve this problem, right? So what do you get? Then what would you think is happening? More vesicles fusing. Why are more vesicles fusing? More calcium in there, right? Residual calcium. This is what we talked about last time a little bit, I think. Is that when you stimulated, calcium came in, but the calcium can't get pumped out, can't get exchanged out, can't bind to the calcium proteins fast enough, or be taken up into the ER, or the mitochondria, so you have calcium hanging around in there, and then boom, here comes another action potential down, opens up where calcium comes in, tries to go out, but boom, another action potential, calcium is building up more and more and more, and what's it doing? Binding to synaptic tag and causing more vesicles to fuse, and you get a bigger event. Right? So presynaptically, then, more vesicles fusing with multiple events. Why is that so important? So this is called short-term facilitation, STF. Short-term facilitation. Due to residual calcium. Bernard Katz came up with this idea of residual calcium. He lowers the calcium, you got to lower short-term facilitation. Right? You didn't build up as much. So that's pretty cool. Why is this so neat? Well, this event depended on the events before, right? You know, how much calcium came in, right? So if it depends on what came before, what does that tell you? It has some kind of memory. This is the beginning of understanding synaptic transmission and having a memory. They were thinking this was the mechanism of memory in the nervous system. That it depended on what happened before and you changed your response later. That this could be some of the fundamental principles of how your nervous system might remember, re-stimulating it over and over again. It was at that time, this was a big thing. Because now we knew that it depended on what happened before. That's pretty cool. Bernard Katz did some other neat experiments and other things. But I mentioned that this was the first time shown actually in which preparation? Your favorite prep? The crayfish preparation, actually. In 1971, some of this actually was worked out as well in the next aspect that I'm going to talk about. And that is, you could wait a little while, a minute or two, stimulate again, and you got a bigger response this time. So Bernard Katz, let me just make sure, Bernard Katz described this in the 1950s. This next event I'm going to talk about was described in 1971. And I'm not trying to, you don't have to memorize years and stuff like that. It's just the idea that if you waited some time here and you gave another stimulus, this event is bigger than that first event. So now we're waiting minutes. Wow, minutes. And you got a bigger response. Even more important about memory, right? So this was a paper that was published in Nature, mentioned before. This is called long-term facilitation, or LTA. A long-term adaptation, or LTF, long-term facilitation. This could not be due to the residual calcium, because calcium was already down. And they found out it really had no effect on that so much, but it had more to effect of proteins inside of here being phosphorylated. So it was phosphorylation-dependent steps.
So that's different than long-term potentiation.
We'll get to that point. It's very similar. Same kind of mechanisms, in a sense.
And again, this is
sub-threshold,
right?
This is all sub-threshold, right? So this was shown, actually, in the crayfish preparation. Went back, they found out in the mammalian preparations, this is how the hippocampus works, this is how your brain works inside of your brain. And if they blocked the phosphorylation-dependent steps, then they could block this response. It would just be back to where it was the normal size before. So they knew that the stimulation of getting calcium loaded inside that nerve terminal, and the amount of calcium was loaded in, the amount of activity could change that nerve terminal over a long period of time. So it could change it over minutes. And what's really interesting, the guy that described the calcium work in this, he was actually a guy from China. It's a real interesting history with this, T.P. Fang. So T.P. Fang went to Bernard Katz and A.B. Hill's lab. These are the gods back in England at the time that were working with synaptic transmission, the squid preps.
And he was the one that actually postulated it was calcium. And then Bernard Katz took that on and went on with it. T.P. Feng was phenomenal. He did lots of things. So remember your first lab with intracellular recordings? Right, that nightmare? And what did you add that caused it to depolarize? Calcium or something else? Potassium, and it depolarized the membrane. T.P. Feng was the one that first described that. Actually, he showed on the frog skin, you can take the frog skin out, you can actually put this in a dish, it's a lab I did as an undergraduate, you put it in the dish, you put frog skin there, and then we would use a leg and we would use the nerves for other things, so you're actually using pretty much the whole animal. And you can take the skin off, you can peel it off the animal, and these little nerves will stick towards the muscle, and you can cut those off. And then you lay that in a dish, put saline on it, and these little nerves are sticking up, put a suction electrode over that, and you can record from that nerve, and you can touch around the skin, and you can map the receptive fields. That's pretty cool. It's a really neat experiment. Well, he showed is if you scratch the skin, you couldn't get any response anymore. And people didn't know why that was. So he postulated it was the cells leaking out potassium, and it depolarized nerve terminals, and you couldn't respond. It's the same thing that happens if you make a welt on your skin, and you keep doing that, and then you touch, you're not as sensitive anymore, because you kind of damaged it. So he actually described that to be potassium. T.P. Feng was an amazing person, actually, just to give you a little history, so it's kind of fun to put history together. He was from China with the cultural revolution that was going on, the communists taking over. He escaped because lots of educated people were being killed, right? So he escaped, and he went to England, worked on his stuff. He came back, and this revolution was going on, and he thought, oh, this is really bad. So he went off to western part of China, became like a farmer, pretending to be uneducated completely, and to survive, because a lot of his colleagues were all being killed. And then after the revolution was over, Cultural Revolution, he then exposed himself being an educated person, working with Bernard Katz and A.B. Hill and describing all these phenomena. He should have got a Nobel Prize because he was really the one that described all this. And they opened up a whole institute for him, the Shanghai Brain Institute. He worked until he was in his 90s, still doing experiments. The government would just give him money because he had the best institute in China to study neuroscience. Many of the people, China's neuroscience depended on T.P. Feng describing this. It's really quite cool. But to think of somebody escaping, trying to avoid being killed because he was educated, that's really something to think about, too. So actually, a lot of this comes from T.P. Feng's understanding. If anybody's interested in history, there's a whole lot of interesting history in neuroscience. Okay, so where are we now with all these tangents? Okay, so now we can speed up a little bit, and we can go through this neuromuscular junction preparation. And these are just images that I'm going to quickly go through. You know, synaptic vesicles and the neuromuscular junction of the frog. You can see those there. They started to look at those with electron microscopy. Other techniques called freeze fracture, where they could actually freeze the preparation, break it open, and actually look inside. They began to see these vesicles fuse. And they could begin to understand more about these spontal responses. I already mentioned this before. Here's your muscle action potential, like in a frog muscle, if you stimulate the nerve terminal. If you record close to the nerve terminal, you see the greater response, threshold, boom, action potential. If you record out here, you just got the action potential. Graded responses, sub-threshold, right? Record out here, lambda, they would all decay, right? Because of lambda, right? Length constant, muscle fibers, same as the nerve terminal or neuron. All right, and then he could actually record along that muscle fiber, and the further you record it out, like one from the psych here to there, just like we explained initially in that squid axon, the smaller the event, right? And if you decayed 63% of the initial event, what is that? You decay 63% of the initial response? Yeah, that is from a distance. That would be lambda. At the same spot, if you chose a particular spot, like right here, or we could choose any of these, if you chose this spot right here, and this is something I didn't go over last time, there's two types of taus. So, I didn't mention that last time, but two taus. And the squid axon, that's why this gets confusing. And your textbooks, they show that squid axon. And they only mention tau like the rise tau. You have two taus, and you might see this. You have a rise tau and a decay tau. The rise tau, for this one, look at this. Now we take
We're not looking at space, we're looking at time, right? Tau, time. You take this amplitude here and you come on down. The time it takes to get to 63%, let's just look at this one right here. This is a distance, right? This is a distance along the prep. We're going to record at that one. The time it takes to rise to 63% of this maximum amplitude is the tau, the rise tau. Now, you could turn this around and think about the decay tau. This amplitude, let's call it 10 millivolts, right? Well, let's find out how long does it take to drop to 63% of that remaining spot, which is like 3.7, right, millivolts. So how long does it take to drop down to 63%? You can draw a line down here and measure the time from here to there. That's decay tau. Okay, so you got a rise tau, you got a decay tau. But if you go back to the beginning of this PowerPoint, you'll see that squid axon with a square pulse and measuring tau. So it gets a little confusing. That's why I try to emphasize those confusing points, right? So you're clear on that.
Could you show the rise tau one more time?
Uh-huh. So rise tau would be the time it would take to reach 63% of whatever one of these you're measuring. So it would be, you draw the peak down to here, and let's say 63% would be about right here. How long does it take from here to here to get to 63% of the rise, right? But why is decay tau so important? Let's put that in context. I know we're going to lose it. It's kind of like getting late, and you're worried about your quiz. It's super hard. I'm joking. It's not super hard. Okay, so decay tau, think about it, what we just drew over here. If decay tau was fast, it wouldn't add, right? Wouldn't add up. So you might not reach the threshold. And think if that's your dendrites in your brain, right? And if it came down each time, even though you're repetitively stimulated, it's like a single event each time, right? And you can't get to the threshold. All right, that's why that's important. All right, so we've got a few minutes here. Okay, so we talked about this. We'll talk about that later. Lambda was the length it takes to decay 63% along an axon. It's like R the muscle fiber, right? The length, the distance. Your tau is time. And tau is R times C, right? Okay. We'll talk about that later. We were talking about threshold. Just to remind you, it is not the transmitter that makes the synapse excitatory or inhibitory. Remember that? It is the receptors that make it excitatory or inhibitory. And this is a good example. You can have a snail neuron and puff acetylcholine on it, and it will actually inhibit it. Right? But generally, most of the cases, right? Glutamate is excitatory. Most of the cases, acetylcholine is excitatory. Most of the cases, GABA is inhibitory. But in development, actually, GABA could actually excite the cells. It depends on the threshold. Remember the Nernst equation, all that good stuff? But in general, we could say glutamate is excitatory. But you have to be careful. You start to talk about serotonin, it depends on the receptor. Some receptors can be inhibitory, will hyperpolarize the cell. Some receptors in serotonin will depolarize the cell. So serotonin depends on the receptor subtype. So you should remember, it's not the transmitter, it's the receptors that make it the response up on the target cell. This is a good example. Acetylcholine on this snail neuron actually opens up and allows chloride to go in the cell. And so chloride is going to hyperpolarize the cell because the E chloride, right, the equilibrium for chloride, is below the resting membrane potential. So it hyperpolarizes and shuts it down. So the point is just to remember that it's the receptors. So a really neat experiment was done on your favorite preparation, crayfish neuromuscular junction. This is a crayfish neuromuscular junction. What's really neat is these neuromuscular junctions have excitatory, glutaminergic synapses, and they have inhibitory GABAergic receptors. Wow. They have inhibition on the muscle fiber. You do not have that. They do. Many invertebrates can have these kind of excitation and inhibition on the muscle fiber. all your innervation to your muscle fibers are excitatory. Your inhibition of the motor response occurs in your spinal cord, either inhibiting or exciting your motor neuron. Okay? This preparation can have this right on the muscle fiber. So the muscle fiber in the crayfish or in invertebrates acts like what? The dendrites in your brain. That's why people study this, because it's integrating the signals. So the GABAergic opens up a chloride channel. Chloride's going to go in if what? If the E. chloride is lower than resting membrane. If it's at the resting membrane, what's going to happen? Nada, right? There's no driving gradient. Right? Okay. Glutamate on the excitatory opens up these channels, these glutamate receptors, which are ion channels, and sodium rushes in. What's going to happen? Where's E sodium? Like plus 55, right? And this is like minus 70. So what's going to happen? Sodium's going to rush in, it's going to depolarize. Right? Okay, so now let's think about this. What do we see here? We see this GABAergic innervation on the motor nerve terminal. So an action potential is coming down the nerve terminal. Boom. Allows calcium to come in, vesicles fuse. But if you stimulated the inhibitor right before then, what's going to happen? GABA is released, opens up a chloride channel. Now comes your action potential. Where's the E chloride? Let's say it's down here close to resting membrane potential. Maybe a little lower than resting membrane potential. Action potential comes down. Up. All of a sudden it hits these chloride channels, which are open. What's it going to do to the shape of the action potential? The action potential is going to try to be high to open up the voltage-gated calcium channels. But if it hits this zone and chloride channels are open, and now what's the E chloride is way down here, but here comes this big action potential, plus 30, what's going to happen? It's going to want to go to the E chloride right away, right? Chloride's going to rush in, and it's going to bring that action potential down to the E chloride. And what's going to happen when it reaches the nerve terminal to the voltage-gated calcium channels? Calcium channels aren't going to open. So what did it do? Because they're voltage-gated calcium channels. It stops synaptic transmission. Presynaptically. This was first described in 1961 by Doodle and Kuffler. Doodle, another one of those gods. He's from Germany. Kuffler. He was the chair of neurobiology at Harvard University, at the medical school. And he described this in 1961. Presynaptic inhibition in the crayfish neuromuscular junction where they could do recordings. Nobody knew this ever occurred before. But then as soon as he published his paper, people began to think, well, we got recordings in the spinal cord of cats and dogs. We couldn't make sense out of it. Could this be possible? And then as soon as they figured this out and showed this, then other experiments began to, we never thought of that. But they showed it with direct experimentation. And the crayfish neuromuscular junction opened up a whole field of understanding how your spinal cord works. Really cool. So that was presynaptic inhibition described at the crayfish neuromuscular junction. And you could see the IPSP is inhibitory versus excitatory. Postsynaptic events, if you had the inhibitor, you could inhibit the excitatory response. Okay, so that's really neat. We talked about the quantal hypothesis already, so I'm just going to cruise through that because we already talked about that. And the more calcium that comes in, the bigger response. Boom, we talked about that. Okay, so we want to get on to this little spot right here. We talked about vesicle fusion, snare complex already, different types of transmitter, right? Usually small amino acids that are responsible for this transmission. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. But here's where I wanted to get to right now because this is kind of important. All right, we'll go to this spot. We'll come back to some of this other stuff. Okay, here's this LTP that I wanted to talk about. In your brain, in rat brains, that's my stop to stop, but we got to do this first. Okay, in rat brains of your brain, this is the hippocampal region. Okay, you can stimulate paths and record in these neurons. And what you could do is when you stimulate, it opens up, glutamate comes out, binds to this receptor called a AMPA receptor. This is really cool. And it opens up an ion channel. So sodium can go in, depolarize that cell. But initially, it doesn't activate these glutamate receptors called NMDA receptors. They can't be activated yet because they have this magnesium plug that's in there. This is the idea of the theory today. But if you depolarize the cell and you make this negative, and then it becomes positive, right? From negative to positive, what's it going to do to the positive 2 plus charge? Kick it out, right? So it kicks it out, and now if you release glutamate the second time, glutamate will bind to not only the AMPA receptors and cause depolarization, but also the NMDA receptors. The NMDA receptors are calcium channels. So it allows calcium to come in, as well as some sodium, potassium to go out, and now you can depolarize the cell a lot more. It's kind of like memory again, right? You know, what happened before can influence the response later. Well, they found out something really interesting. Now, here comes the postsynaptic responses. Let's see what we got here. Yes. If you repetitively stimulate the nerve terminal, they got a bigger response over time. This is wild, right? Remember, we talked about presynaptic responses like residual calcium. So they were wondering, is that possible in the hippocampus slice? Was that going on too? But they found something unique. They found out with repetitive stimulation, you added more AMPA receptors. Wow. So these receptors just stayed right underneath the membrane. Depending on the amount of depolarization, they could be put into the membrane, and now you stimulate, you get a bigger response. So here's a postsynaptic phenomenon, right? More receptors. That's pretty cool. But if you continually stimulate for a long period of time, those receptors could also be pulled out of the membrane, be pulled back into the cell. So now what happens? You don't have any AMPA receptors. So you stimulate, and now you don't get a response, because the NMDA receptors could stay there, but they don't open because it hasn't depolarized yet. So these are the two terms which are referred to as long-term potentiation, like facilitation, long-term responses, because this would go on for a long period of time, or LTD, long-term depression. So you can see that this could really open up a lot of questions about how the nerves work and respond, right? Okay, so now we have a little fun. All right, so groups. 3 to 4 people in a group. What does that mean? Group effort! Yay! Okay, group effort. Put up your notes. Group effort. Are you in a group? Put up your notes. I can hand it out. Get together. So 3 to 4 people in a group. Thank you.
scratch offs before? You scratch your answers off as a group. One scratch, you get the full point. Two scratches, half point. Three scratches, 0 points. Okay? For each question. I'm sure somebody has their fingernails to take another copy of the scratch.
Let's finish this first and then we'll have the questions again.
Thank you.